Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
Before we get started today, it's really tough to talk about video games and even talk about the business of video games with so much going on in our world right now. And we didn't want to begin an episode while protests for justice are going on without acknowledging what's going on in our world.
Absolutely. So today we are acknowledging and mourning the murder of George Floyd and the murders of Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner, Philando Castile, and so many more Black people who have died at the hands of those who claim to protect people.
Black lives matter, and trans rights are human rights. Amanda, part of your work throughout your career has been focused on the importance of diversity and inclusivity. And I've learned so much from you and from a number of our friends who have taken the time and the emotional energy to share their experiences with me and with us and with you through your work. I've learned so much. We're so fortunate, especially to have had Carrie on the interview or on the show earlier this week. And she talked a lot about this as well.
She did. So Carrie's my big takeaway from the interview that we had with Carrie is that diversity and inclusion isn't just a program. It isn't just something that you do. It's something that you instill in the culture of every piece of the work that you're doing every single day. And Carrie's big emphasis has been on building a diverse quality assurance team at Private Division. And her philosophy is really around, if you don't have a diverse set of skills, a diverse range of backgrounds, and a diverse approach to gaming in general, how can you truly, truly test a game and understand how it's supposed to work or how it's not working if you don't employ and invite in a number of different perspectives?
If you're interested in hearing more about Carrie Toyama's perspective, her work as lead producer on Disintegration, and her career and her very interesting career path through QA and building out, as you talked about, the QA department at Private Division, you can go back and listen to our previous episode, which was, I guess, episode 23,
yes,
which we recorded earlier this week. But our message here is that enough is enough. Our leadership is failing us. People are dying, and protest is necessary, especially when all other means have failed. Being quiet does not work. Asking nicely does not work.
We stand with those who have been and continue to be outraged and hurt, those whose hearts have been broken because the institutions that claim to protect have become true instruments of terror. Please consider donating to the Minnesota Freedom Fund. We'll put the donation link in the show notes. Black lives matter, and trans rights are human rights.
And with that, we'll go ahead and get started on this week's news episode. Sadly, BlizzCon is the latest casualty of the pandemic.
And BlizzCon usually happens the beginning of November. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty indicative of what we can be seeing for even potentially PAX Unplugged.
It's true. And again, PAX West hasn't yet been canceled. Obviously, they're waiting on guidance from
the government
in Washington.
Sure.
In Washington State.
Yes.
So we'll probably hear about that soon, but I don't expect PAX West to happen. PAX Unplugged, you know, that's a big question mark as well right now. So yeah, BlizzCon will not be happening this year. Blizzard has said that it will be planning, hopefully. This is not set in stone. They're still working out logistics. An online event. And if it does happen, it will be early next year. So that wipes out 2020. That takes us into early 2021. But just to remind you from our discussion about Activision Blizzard's 2019 earnings, World of Warcraft saw increased usership.
For both new and returning players.
Absolutely. In fact, all Blizzard games have seen an increase in month-on-month usership as a result of the quarantine. We are still expecting a new World of Warcraft expansion this fall. Shadowlands, I believe.
I think it's Shadowlands, yeah. Hopefully it will be better received, both critically from from our peers and from the community. It's kind of a, it's been a bit of a touch and go kind of expansion.
WoW has been so interesting to me because I've never played it. It's always been this thing out there where I kind of understand some of the tropes. I mean, I played the original RTS games, but I never played WoW. So it's kind of this thing that exists in this cultural bubble for me.
Like most MMOs, you mean?
Like
for
most
you?
MMOs, absolutely. Let's see. Diablo Immortal regional testing is going to be later this year. And again, there was no mention of Diablo 4 when they announced their earnings. Just as a reminder, Rod Ferguson was brought in.
He is the guy who closes.
He's the closer, right? So he's going to be working with the Diablo team to bring Diablo 4 home. And then just wanted to read this from Sarah Lynn Smith's statement. That BlizzCon statement, she's the executive producer of BlizzCon. We're talking about how we might be able to channel the BlizzCon spirit and connect with you in some way online, far less impacted by the state of health and safety protocols for mass in-person gatherings. We'd want to do this as soon as we could, but given that this is newish territory and the different factors involved, it will most likely be sometime early next year. BlizzCon is also a stage for big esports, so that's Overwatch. That is still Heroes of the Storm.
And StarCraft.
And Hearthstone.
And Hearthstone. Well, Hearthstone less so, and Heroes of the Storm less so. But yes, I mean, the big draw is definitely Overwatch. So Continue, please.
So BlizzCon is also a stage for big esports events and Blizzard games each year. So we're also looking into alternatives for supporting some of the high-level competition that would normally take place at the show.
So I've attended BlizzCon.
You have?
I went in, what was it, 2018?
It was.
That was my first BlizzCon. It was bonkers. There was lots of people there, mm-hmm. but it was really friendly. Everyone was really nice, and they had, like, this little, like, offshoot where you could sit down with your Switch and play Diablo 3.
Yeah.
It was really great.
That port is still so good.
Yeah. We want to talk about some solid, like, Mike and I could talk about porting for Diablo 3 until the cows come home and we find the cow level. Moo.
Moo.
But yeah, the great thing about BlizzCon is that it really does bring people together from every different facet of Blizzard's fan base. There's something for everybody there. There's something for the esports fans with Overwatch, with StarCraft, Heroes of the Storm, Hearthstone. There are new game announcements. There is there are like cosplayers that come in and they look amazing. They do interviews on stage. Like, it is a celebration of everything Blizzard, and not having that in person, even though they do have an online component.
In fact, I covered at Game Informer, my experience with BlizzCon is covering it. So I had the BlizzCon stream on for the entire weekend, and I would cover it.
But it's different to stream from a live event mm-hmm. versus having to concoct all of this in a multitude of different homes and different mm-hmm. spaces. So I can totally empathize with how Sarah Lynn ended up needing to phrase this, where it's like, look, we want to do something. We want to channel this spirit, but it's not going to be the same thing. Mm-hmm. Mike, do you think that they would have been announcing anything big at BlizzCon this year? This is completely speculative, so don't take this with anything other than a grain of salt.
Yeah, it's important that we caveat that. I don't know.
Maybe we would have seen Overwatch 2.
Maybe. We know that the last hero they released was the last.
Yeah, it was the Overwatch. It was the last Overwatch hero, the original Overwatch hero.
Yeah,
for the original Overwatch, rather.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't know. I think that Overwatch 2 is probably the only one that I would have expected to see. I don't think I would have expected to see anything other than maybe a new Diablo 4 cinematic.
Maybe some gameplay trailer. But here's the thing with BlizzCon is that typically if they're going to show that, they have it on the floor.
They do, because they want people to be hype about it, and they want it to be a really special experience for Blizzard fans when they mm-hmm. show up at BlizzCon. So yeah, when they announce, like, hey, check it out, we're going to have Warcraft 3 Reforged, it was right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the only things that they didn't have, obviously, was Diablo Immortal and... what was the other one? I think there was an expansion that was announced that they didn't have yet, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, Blizzard has a very specific way of doing things. I think you're right. I think that if they were going to show gameplay, they would just have a demo on the floor.
And maybe they would have been able to get that slice ready, but who knows?
That's, yeah.
All right. So that's BlizzCon. The other thing I wanted to point out, so obviously with everything that's been canceled and everything that has shifted to online, it is hard to keep track of everything that's going on. Jeff Grubb has kept a good list, but also, what is his name? Cheesemeister3K on Twitter. I believe he's an analyst in Japan. But he has a list of, like, E3 press conference times. So he's got like, obviously we know Devolver Digital is coming, but that's TBA. Microsoft's 2020, their next one. I don't think we're going to see that. I think that's...
see which?
We're going to see a June inside Xbox. We know that July is going to be first party.
Yes.
So I don't think know if that, we're going to see one in June.
Well, I mean, if we're going to see anything in June, it'll be either as a part of IGN's showcase or Keighley's showcase.
Sure. But Sony, we'll talk about this a little bit later, has something coming up on Thursday. Man, we're right about where E3 would have been. PC Gaming Show.
Well, I mean, we're about, what, 2 weeks out from E3 at this point? Less than 2 weeks out? Week and a half?
Yeah, something like that. Limited Run is slated for Monday the 8th. EA Play Live is Thursday the 11th. Ubisoft is Sunday the 12th. So that's where we're kind of getting into.
That's getting into E3 time. Pre-3, one might say.
Between Jeff Grubb's list, which is really good, and some of the other lists floating around, you know, it's tough to keep track of all of these little events that are coming. And there's the Guerrilla one, which isn't Guerrilla, the Horizon studio. They're just like Guerrilla Collective, they're called. Which is where we're going to see Baldur's Gate 3. There was a.
Right.
Did you see that trailer today?
No, that's going to be entirely up my alley. I need to sit and I need to wait for it for when I'm in a space where I can experience it, because you know how much I love me some Baldur's Gate.
Yeah. So, we'll cover the big business beats that come out of those. We're not going to cover like all the major gameplay stuff. Like that's. There are others.
Unless
who
we
do
get
that.
Really excited.
Unless we get really excited like about Baldur's Gate 3. But for the most part, like, any big business beats come out of that, including the Sony stuff that is next week. We'll talk about that. So there are resources online, but there's no good unified schedule.
No.
Because everything is so scattered this year.
And if you missed it, there was also this really interesting thing that I have not watched yet, which was all about Wholesome Games.
Yes, Wholesome Games.
That was basically made for me. I love me some Wholesome Games. Actually, it feels like every game is made for me. I just really like video games.
Hey, that's not a bad place to be.
That's the dream.
It's true.
It's the dream. Yeah. All right, well, let's talk about GE Force now. This has been a really weird story.
Yeah, we originally covered this way back on episode 2, which was March 18th.
Yes.
And we had Brandon on the show.
So he's the founder of Odin Law and Media. So we were talking about some of the weird legalities around how they were approaching content with GE Force Now and how it was different from, like, Blade Shadow and some of the other services out there, where it was one of these things where it was confusing as to what kind of an ecosystem it was. Mm-hmm. So they were putting games on their service that they did not have permission to put on their service. Mm-hmm. So it turned into an opt-out thing, which made people very upset, understandably.
Sure, because you had Bethesda and 2K and others who had their games that were on this service, and they're like, wait a minute. Activision was on there,
so yeah.
What happened was, the way GeForce Now works is it connects to your storefronts and says, hey, you own this game on Steam. We're going to let you stream it over the cloud, so you don't actually have to download it.
Which is really, really interesting.
It's
an interesting way of handling it. It's very different than, say, how Blade Shadow does it, because that's an actual...
It's a virtual machine.
It's a virtual machine that you have access to, that you can install games onto that you own, versus just being like, oh, we noticed you have a license for this game. Now you can play it in the cloud, but there's a lot of other, like, legal gray area there.
Sure. So there are two different account structure. There's two different account types on GeForce Now. There's free accounts that you get 1 hour sessions and you don't get priority. So what happens is you go in the queue when your number comes up, you get kicked into your game.
Number 48.
Exactly. You get kicked into your game. You get to play for an hour and then it boots you back into the queue. Now, if you pay for $5 a month, which is an introductory rate,
it's gotta be introductory.
Yeah, it's $5 a month. You get longer sessions. So it's up to 6 hours. So you can play for up to 6 hours when your 6 hours are up.
That's pretty chunky.
Yeah, and you get priority. So you might not experience much of a delay at all.
You get into the queue and you get right into the game.
Exactly.
Instead of being like Final Fantasy 14, where we're sitting in the queue forever and ever and all we want to do is raid.
Yeah. But that was only that one time.
That was pretty bad.
So what's interesting, so here's what Brandon Huffman had to say way back on that episode. When you're the owner of the copyright, so we're talking about Bethesda and 2K and Activision, all those who pulled their games from GeForce Now after it launched, right? It launched with all of these games from all these publishers and they didn't really have permission. When you're the owner of the copyright, you have certain exclusive rights. One of those rights is the right to make copies. Based on what I've seen about the NVIDIA platform, which is GeForce Now, I think it requires them to make a copy of the game that lives on their server. The right to distribute is another copyright-protected right. Your purchase on Steam entitles you to a licensed copy through Steam. It doesn't entitle NVIDIA to make a copy separate and apart from your licensed version in order to deliver their service. So
that's a really, really important set of distinctions. And I think that that is part of what really upset these developers and these publishers, because it's like, look, you don't, nothing has legally entitled you to be able to do this. You are essentially redistributing and relicensing our stuff, even though this license, the original license agreement didn't actually allow you to do this.
Plus there's the whole financial aspect. Is NVIDIA paying these developers and publishers anything to include them on the service?
If they're paying, if all it is $5 a month, I'm going to say no.
Yeah. So they just changed their licensing structure from an opt-out
into an opt-in.
To an opt-in.
So the opt-in process.
This is a quote that I threw into the show notes
here. Okay, so this is a direct quote. So this includes this new opt-in process for developers and publishers. They were saying that the response has been strong, with over 200 publishers committing to streaming on the service. GeForce Now, this is them actually, you know, defining what GeForce Now is, because it's like, what is this? GeForce Now is an extension of the PC ecosystem. There is no cost for developers. Games just run without difficult porting requirements. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Helping them reach millions of players who don't have game-ready PCs. Going forward, only the games that are opted in will be available on the service, providing confidence in the GeForce Now game library. Some publishers are still figuring out their cloud strategies. Those that haven't opted in as of May 31st will be removed.
Now, what's interesting here is I actually really like this positioning, because they're saying, hey, we're part of the existing PC ecosystem instead of a separate platform.
Yeah, we don't want to be considered, you know, like encroaching on the PC space. We consider ourselves an extension of the PC space.
And I really like that. And again, it solves that gap that Blade Shadow does, which is I don't want to pay to upgrade my hardware all the time. Therefore, I'm going to pay you a subscription fee.
Or I don't have the money to.
Yeah.
All I've got is like my crappy Chromebook that's all I can afford. You know, it's again, this all comes back to inclusion, right? We talk about inclusion as something that's so important, and these kinds of initiatives and these kinds of ways that we are trying to, you know, narrow the gap between the haves and the have-nots is so, so, so important, and making sure that, you know, gaming can be accessible for anybody.
And again, absolutely. And again, this is very different than what Google's attempting with Stadia, which is selling you games on a separate platform that you might already own somewhere else, or you cannot play offline. You're not downloading those games.
Yeah, I really... Mike and I have a lot of feelings about Stadia, but we're not going to get into that right now.
So here's the thing. I looked at the list. Sega, Versus Evil, Clay, Skybound, Supergiant, Jackbox. And I say Skybound because there's some Walking Dead, old Telltale stuff.
Okay.
That's in there. Those games are going to get pulled unless there's a conversation that happens and things reverse course.
Right.
Interestingly, Hinterland, so Raphael Van Lerop, they make The Long Dark. He was very vocal when this all happened. They pulled The Long Dark from GeForce Now because it took their autonomy away. It took their agency away as a developer
to be able to determine where it was that their game was going to be distributed.
Mm-hmm. And Raphael actually issued a statement on The Long Dark's website. So this was yesterday.
Oh, nice.
Yep. So you guys are listening to this on Saturday. We're recording on Friday. So this was Thursday.
Time is a social construct.
Yep. And here is what he had to say. Back in March, I decided to remove The Long Dark from NVIDIA's GeForce Now game streaming platform as I disagreed with our game being incorporated into the service without our consent. This week, NVIDIA announced that they are shifting to an opt-in program for getting games onto GeForce Now. As a result of this change, Lerop said, The Long Dark will go back to being streamable on GeForce Now immediately. So there's an optics thing. There's just a relationship management thing here. So remember, business isn't just about the dollars and cents. There's a big relationship component.
And part of building a relationship, building any relationship, is trust. And it has to be mutual. It can't just be a, well, whatever, dude, I got your game. Like, this guy got your game on Steam. So what's the big deal? Mm-hmm. You know, it's more inclusive like that. It's better for the ecosystem as a whole to have that be a more inclusive conversation where you're calling devs and publishers in. We're like, we want you to be a part of this. We want you to be a part of extending the PC ecosystem and making PC gaming available to more people. And we think that what you're doing as a publisher, as a developer, is really important. So we want your game. Bring us your game. Want game.
Yes.
As opposed to here's the game without your permission.
Yeah. I think what's likely to happen is GeForce Now is going to lose the games from those developers and publishers that I mentioned. I was really impressed, actually, when I looked at the list. I had no idea that they had 2,000 plus games on their list, and they've got 200 plus developers and publishers. That is a strong foundation. Now, because they actually called out, like, here are the games that are going to go away if nothing happens come March 30th or May 31st.
Right.
I actually think, and I said this when the service was first launched before we knew anything about the opt-out drama, legitimate concerns, that this service, I think, has a lot of legs, especially when you put it up against Stadia. So, and the reason I say that is because Stadia, being the other major service that's reliant on game streaming. The other interesting thing is they talked about GeForce Now being a piece of Steam Cloud, like and Steam streaming stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that NVIDIA, it's a major player, it's a major partner, and that was the other tricky part. You know, NVIDIA makes graphics cards, right?
Yeah.
And they are partners. A lot of PC game manufacturers, PC game developers and publishers, they partner up with either AMD or NVIDIA.
Yes, absolutely. And so, sometimes they partner up to do, you know, like they partner up to put codes in with their video cards and stuff like that. I can't tell you how many video games I've gotten as a result of picking up my GeForce card. And I'm like, oh, there's a game in here.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So, I mean, there's marketing relationships.
Yeah.
There is primary platform like you would see on console relationships. So this was a really tricky thing for them to navigate to begin with.
Yeah.
So I think that things are going to right. The ship is going to right. I feel like the service is probably going to get back on better footing now that it is going to move past this friction with partners. So that's that update. Speaking of big companies
that really don't know much about video games.
So we talked a little bit about, again, we're not going to go deep into Stadia. Obviously, that platform has had its struggles. Amazon, as you may recall, is now in the games industry. This might come as a surprise to you.
As opposed to just being in the game tools industry?
Yeah. I mean,
with Lumberyard and with AWS?
Right. So Lumberyard is a version of CryEngine.
I think it's
a tuned, tweaked version of CryEngine. I'm not aware of any games that are running on Lumberyard except this one that we're about to talk about.
I don't know what the deal is with them licensing Lumberyard. I know that AWS is essential to many developers' live service games,
sure.
But Lumberyard, I'm not so sure about. But the big thing that we want to talk about is we want to talk about Amazon Game Studios' first released game. It's not their first
released.
Announced game. This is their first released game.
Yes. And it came out last week?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it came out last week.
Oh, boy. So...
All right. So let's talk about Crucible.
Yeah.
Mike, walk us through some numbers here.
Okay. So I have not played it. I have not even watched more than a couple of moments of video of it. So I'm not going to comment on its quality other than to say that it has been critically panned. It got a 48 from PC Gamer and a 40 from IGN or a 4.0 from IGN. I don't know how IGN scores work.
I think it's 4.0.
Yeah, I know that they shifted their scores around, but 48 and 40. Oh, I know. I pulled these from Metacritic. That's why.
Oh.
So it's 48, not like a 4.0.
Yeah, got it.
So that's obviously one issue, and that's critical response.
That's critical response. And critical response does not always reflect how the community will end up feeling about
it.
Because critics think one way about games because they're professionals, and it's like film critics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just because a film critic likes a film doesn't mean that, you know, your average human being is going to find joy in...
Or vice versa.
Exactly.
But what we do look at is we look at the number of people who are playing. Now, this is an this is a free-to-play game,
yes,
I believe.
This is a free-to-play game.
It is an, it's a game as a service.
Yes.
Which means that your user base is your life and your death.
That was ominous.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about death, Michael?
Because when I pulled this yesterday.
You did.
The 24-hour peak yesterday was 3,000 players concurrently.
Okay, all right. Put this number into context, though.
Sure. So all time, though, it peaked at 10,600 concurrents.
Sure.
In its first week. Now, standard decay curves are different in service games. You know, yes. We don't have your typical game as a product has a very different decay curve.
That's right.
Than a game as a service, which can go through a variety of different resurgences and has the chance to be fixed and all that stuff. But
it's a big but, Mike.
So Riot came out today and announced that during Valorant's closed beta.
So that's Riot's new hero shooter, which actually looks really heckin' cool. Mm-hmm. And if I were into playing hero shooters, I'm pretty sure I would be into Valorant.
And Crucible is kind of a hero shooter.
Ish.
Yeah, I mean, I would suggest reading PC Gamer's review only because it does a really good job of breaking down the challenges that each of the different modes has. It has some more traditional multiplayer shooter modes.
But it's it's honestly probably the more holistic review, mm-hmm. one of the most holistic reviews that I've seen about Crucible.
So
Valorant, what kind of numbers is Valorant pulling down?
3 million.
And I'm sorry, that was during its what?
Per day, during its closed beta. And it goes wide on June 2nd.
Okay, so let's beep back up for a quick second.
Meep.
So Riot, we have to put this into context, right? Like Riot has League of Legends.
Yes.
And Legends of Runeterra.
Yes.
And now Valorant.
Yes. They have a community.
They have a huge community. It's already enormous.
Yeah.
So I feel like I get it,
mm-hmm.
but also apples and oranges because Amazon Game Studios doesn't have that same built-in base unless you count Twitch.
Right. And you think that they would tap into that. Now, I did not see any promotion for Crucible leading up to the game's release.
No, I didn't either.
So I
didn't
don't
even
know.
See any hubbub about it.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. You think that they would have had streamers talking about it. And again, I don't watch a lot of streams, but there was no buzz. There was no social media buzz like you've seen around Overwatch, like you saw around Valorant. Like Valorant had huge social media buzz.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were a lot of not just popular streamers talking about Valorant, but like, you know, just regular streamers that are, you know, they're fairly popular, but they're not like upper echelon. Yeah.
So right there, we've compared Crucible's launch to a very successful launch in the same genre. Now, I wanted to pull some other numbers because I wanted to compare this to a launch that is deemed to have been a failure. Now, this is not in the same genre, but it is a powerhouse company, an enormous company with a huge install base, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm talking about Valve. And I'm talking about Artifact, which was their Richard Garfield-designed digital trading card game. Collectible card game.
Yes, and we have some serious love for Richard Garfield in this household.
Absolutely.
Because
big Magic fans.
Yeah, we've played a lot of Magic. I used to play in Magic tournaments as a kid.
Keyforge is excellent.
Keyforge is a fantastic game. So when Artifact came out, and we're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
But I wanted to pull those numbers just to get an idea.
Please.
Now, remember, Artifact met serious resistance in the community. Its monetization wasn't
That's
great.
Right.
There were some big issues there. It led Valve to completely retool it, and Artifact is about to like relaunch. But what is deemed a failure, right?
Mm-hmm.
It had in its first full month, so that was the month of December 2018.
Yes,
46,656 players concurrently. And it had about 60,000 or so at the end of November when it actually like launched. So it launched, I think, on November 28th, 2018. So again, we're comparing, let's say the first, like again, we're going to use that 46,000 number, 46,656 peak concurrence in its first full month. And again, I pulled this from Steam Charts, which is where the Crucible data comes from.
Yes.
Versus 10,600 for Crucible in its first week. And you assume that the new hotness, if it's
hotness.
At all hot, is going to, that's where those numbers are going to be high. Now, just to give you an understanding of where Artifact went, Artifact fell off a cliff come January 2019. And if this is where Crucible's starting...
People were exhausted with the monetization scheme because it was so punishing.
So yeah, so this is not a one-to-one comparison, but I thought it was important to pull numbers from a failed launch or a launch
what
that...
What is considered to be...
Considered a, yeah.
What is considered to be a failure?
Now here's the real challenge. And I caught this in... Yang Si Lu on Twitter posted some thoughts about this where they had heard... that the game cost around $300 million to make over 4 years with a team size of about 250. Now, Michael Pachter, who's an analyst at Wedbush Securities, pushed back on that a little bit, although he did say that Lou was closer to the data. But according to Pachter, it was a rumored 200-person dev team and $100 million to dev this game. However, if you did lump in the lumberyard costs and the specific tech needed for this game, yes, you could get closer to that $300 million.
That's a big budget for so few concurrents.
Yes. So again, we putting this in context of how rough this looks right now.
Oh, boy.
And this wasn't their first attempt at a online team game. In fact, you demoed for PC Gamer. You previewed for PC Gamer.
I did.
Breakaway.
I actually had a lot of fun with Breakaway. It wasn't a good game. But I like... But I'm such a weird hype monster. This is why I shouldn't be reviewing games, like, for consumers. Because I just like every game. But I was critical about Breakaway. There were a number of issues, including, like, how obtuse the controls were. And, like, it didn't actually feel like you were accomplishing anything. But in terms of the mechanics, Breakaway was... shockingly enjoyable. It was a sports MOBA.
A sports MOBA, right?
Yeah, and it was like, it was one of those games where it had no business being as jaunty and as playful as it was. It was like, oh, this is actually really cute and really, like, fun. But as a long-term game, I just couldn't see it. I saw it as something cute to play, you know, in that moment, but that wouldn't be something that I would find particularly sticky.
Yeah, it's,
I can't remember what my exact comments were about Breakaway, because I think I made those comments in like 2017, so it was a long time ago. It was a long time. It was a different lifetime ago.
All right, so just to be really clear, so that one, when you played Breakaway, was Double Helix developing that?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so they paused development or canceled Breakaway. So Crucible was developed by Relentless Studios, which is internal at Amazon Games.
Okay.
Amazon also picked up Double Helix, which was Double Helix that was working on Breakaway.
Yes.
Now Double Helix was the original developer on the Xbox One Killer Instinct. When Amazon picked them up, that development for Killer Instinct shifted over to Iron Galaxy.
That's right.
Whew.
Yes. Got it.
Whew.
So it's a really complicated web of development that kind of went into Crucible and Breakaway. I still think Breakaway probably was the better game, but I think it wasn't as trendy. It became not as trendy because it's like, oh, it's a MOBA. Who wants to play a MOBA? I'm like, guys, but it's a sports MOBA. This is actually pretty cute.
So here's the big thing that we're kind of taking away from this, and this is Matthew Ball. On Twitter, he is the former head of strategy for Amazon Studios.
Yes.
And here's what he had to say. I think it's reasonable to say that if you're Amazon and if you're getting into games this late, an engine can make sense. Indeed, one could argue only sense in getting into consumer-facing game services is to drive an engine. So this kind of comes back to the whole spend. So assuming Pachter is right, and then it was $100 million for Crucible, and the other $200 million or so was Lumberyard, that's $200 million. And I come back to the question I asked at the beginning of this segment.
Who's using it? Do we know where it's being licensed? Like, nope. I don't think that's information that's readily available at this point in time.
Well, if you're Epic or you're Unity, you're touting who's using your engine, right?
I mean, you're not wrong.
So,
you're not wrong.
And that's the thing, like, Unity and Unreal are out there. CryEngine, I don't believe, from what I've heard from developers, is as easy to work with as Unreal Engine is and Unity is.
Putting my developer hat on just for a quick second, because my very, very old life is in computer science and in software development. So remember that different kinds of languages and therefore different kinds of engines are useful in different kinds of scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't know what Lumberyard scenario is. Like, I know what Unity's use cases look like. I know what Unreal's use cases look like.
And then we have the proprietary engines, like EA's got Frostbite. Ubisoft has like 7,000 engines, including Snowdrop.
And then there's Avalanche.
Yep.
Avalanche has their own engine. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean, and it's the same thing with Remedy. Remedy has their engine as
Northlight.
Well. Earthlight, that's right. So I mean, engines are an integral part to the way development studios are pulling together their games. Usually if you are using an off the shelf, quote unquote, engine, it's because you don't have the internal R&D to develop your own.
Or you don't want to bear that expense and the
technical. Because it's a lot of money to put into R&D to build your own engine. That's a lot of man hours. That's a lot of code.
In fact, I want to relay a quick story. Our friend Mike Laidlaw,
who
was integral in the Dragon Age series when he was with BioWare.
Yes.
My first meeting with him was the first hands-on for Dragon Age Inquisition. And I had spent the entire week leading up to that because I had slept on Dragon Age 2. I played Origins right when it came out. Dragon Age 2 I slept on. I finally, like, I have to play Dragon Age 2 before I go play Inquisition. And I'm sitting there and I'm really fascinated by the fact that you could, you know, not just pause the action like you could in the previous games, but you could kind of slowly wind it forward. And what Mike told me, and I think this made it into my Game Informer story about this, is that when they got their hands on Frostbite, there was really no functionality to just pause. So it was all on a spectrum. It was linear, right? So they found out that not only if they wound the clock, you know, forward momentum down to zero, you could essentially affect a pause, but you could slowly wind things forward. And that's one of the coolest parts of Dragon Age Inquisition, right? You can
see you.
I'm such a nerd.
You are such a nerd. Also, the best part of Dragon Age Inquisition is Blackwall, and I will not hear anything else about it.
Anyway, so yeah. So one of the things that kind of comes out of that is, you know, EA applying its Frostbite engine kind of across its studios means that there are use cases. That is an engine that was built around Battlefield. That was built by DICE, built for Battlefield, built for shooters. So it's great for Battlefield. It's great for Battlefront. But when you're talking about other use cases, when you're talking about sports and when you're talking about an RPG.
You gotta shoehorn it.
Yeah.
And that's tough.
Or you're building out documentation and new features and you're kind of working around.
Well, but that's the thing is you end up working around. Honestly, we should just get some brilliant developers to come in and talk to us about engines so that we have this definitive information. Because for me, I'm looking at this from a language perspective and I'm just like, I don't know, different languages are used for different things. I've never actually worked in a game engine before. I tried Unity. I don't think I'm smart enough for Unity.
So we'll revisit that topic down the road. But that was kind of our interesting note on Amazon's first game launch, and I'm curious to see if they're able to pick it up and recover. You know, recovery stories, like redemption stories, we're no stranger to them anymore. I mean, we talk about this all the time. We talk about Diablo 3. We talk about Final Fantasy 14. Yeah, so it's possible.
Hopefully, we will be talking about Anthem.
Yep.
In a year-ish.
Absolutely.
Maybe, I hope. I love redemption stories. I love it when games come back from the brink and show us how just incredible developers are when, like, everyone, when everything is falling down around them and they are just, oh my goodness. I just love video games, Mike.
I know.
I don't know if I said this to you today.
I think you might have mentioned it.
I really love video games.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some more video games.
Yeah.
Specifically, let's talk about Marvelous and Tencent.
Yes.
So Tencent put down a 20% investment in Marvelous.
Yes, they now have a 20% stake in the company. So Marvelous, in case our listeners aren't aware, they have released Story of Seasons, Friends of Mineraltown, Daemon X Machina on Switch and then PC, Rune Factory series, the East RPG series, Senran Kagura, more games. Marvelous has been around for a while. They have a pretty large library.
They do. So Tencent ended up spending 7 billion yen or $65 million US and are now considered the largest shareholder at Marvelous.
Yes. And the reason for that is they acquired shares from the previous largest shareholders, which is Amuse Capital and Marvelous CEO Hayao Nakayama.
Which leads me to believe that maybe Hayao Nakayama is looking to leave
I don't know
Marvelous potentially, because this feels a lot like Nexon, that's what I was thinking of. I don't know. It was a mess, but it was really interesting because the CEO wanted to get out, and he's like, hey, can somebody please just come buy my shares? And then they didn't actually end up making it work with anybody.
It was really interesting.
But that was really neat. That's kind of what this reminds me of.
So what was really interesting, Marvel is in its statement about the investment from Tencent. Says, quote, in comparison to Western companies, there's a widening abyss in terms of development capability and financial clout.
Interesting.
So taking that investment, so this is, you know, so Marvelous is a Japanese company, so they're taking Chinese investment. So this is a growing trend, and Marvelous here talking about why they made the decision to sell these shares.
So Cirque and Toto, as additional context, so he's the founder of analyst firm Canton Games, and he's also based in Japan. So he does a ton of analysis for Japanese companies. We've chatted with Cirque a number of times.
Absolutely.
You know, his perspective is usually, if I need to know something about the Japanese games market, I will go talk to Cirque. Mm-hmm. So here's what he was quoted to say to Reuters. Quote, Tencent is after the magic of Japanese countries creating otaku, geek-oriented content. So he is specifically referring to the niche but lucrative fan base for product spending games, animation, and comic books. So looking at transmedia, really. And Japanese companies are amazing at transmedia. Like, I can't say this definitively, that they are like the original transmedia folks out there, but I would imagine so.
Yeah, like, makes sense.
Manga
and anime.
Yeah, exactly. And then moving into television, which moves it. Because, like, we could just even look at the lifespan of Pokemon, for crying out loud. Like, television and anime, like the anime that they had in Japan, which was moved into, you know, cartoons. Mm-hmm. Oh, remember when anime was called cartoons?
Yes.
And into video games and everything like that. So, yeah, transmedia, man.
Yeah, and, you know, for those of you who aren't as aware of Tencent, and, you know, obviously they're the largest gaming company, their largest media company.
I think they are the largest media company in China.
They have their fingers in a lot of pies.
They do.
They have an investment in Epic. They are full owners of Riot Games.
They are, yes.
And they recently helped Ubisoft out by purchasing, I believe it was 5% stake in the company to prevent the Vivendi hostile takeover. In fact, you can read more about that. There's a piece I wrote for Polygon. That we published shortly after the Ubisoft investment, and we'll drop that link into the show notes. All right, speaking of deals, we love deals.
Spin the wheel for a deal.
Yeah. EA has renewed its contract with the NFL and the NFL Players Association through 2026.
That is hefty. That's a hefty renewal. When was the last time they renewed?
I believe it was the same period of time, so we're looking at about 5 years. And they have... they've been exclusive since, I think, 2005.
That sounds about right.
Right? So NFL 2K5 was the last football sim to be released from 2K,
I think. Yeah. That was, my goodness, that was a long time
ago. I liked 2K. I played both Madden and 2K back then. I liked 2K.
I don't have anything to say about sports ball, unfortunately.
So, the reason why we're calling that out, you know, so the Ultimate Team revenue, and we pulled this from the EA earnings, quarter four was very service heavy. Madden Ultimate Team had its best year yet in the fiscal year that ended on March 31st, 2020.
And we've talked heavily about what Ultimate Team means for EA and for their net bookings over the course of a fiscal year.
In fact.
Do it!
Across all of EA's sports titles, that includes FIFA and Madden, EA generated a total of $1.49 billion through the Ultimate Team platform. That's a $120 million increase on last year's revenue total of $1.37 billion. Now, I just actually want to walk this back a little bit because Dan Ahmad from Nico Partners tweeted this out.
Dan's so smart.
Yep. So, obviously, so this year... full fiscal year, $1.49 billion from Ultimate Team. Last year, $1.37 billion. Fiscal 2018, $1.18 billion. Fiscal 2017, $775 million. Fiscal year 2016, $660 million. Fiscal year 2015, $587 million. They have almost increased in 5 years, right?
Yeah, I guess 5 years, five fiscal years.
Five, six, seven, eight, nine, Six.
Six?
Six okay. fiscal years. Almost $1 billion more in Ultimate Team. Ultimate Team is so important to EA's bottom line, and Madden having its biggest year. FIFA is even bigger.
It
FIFA's is the original Ultimate Team. It's still huge. It yep. has global appeal. Now yes. remember, Madden is
very largely American. Very
largely American.
And maybe some Canadian, maybe.
So, yeah, it but it's growing still, and it had yes. its best year. Yeah. Now, we also know that 2K is making NFL games again, but they are not competing with Madden because EA has the exclusive license on sim games.
Right. So what kind of games can we expect to see then?
So, I mean, there's a couple. I think they said they're not going to compete with Madden, so they're not going to do like an off-brand...
Madden-ish.
Yeah, an off-brand sim with made-up teams. Now, that was a big thing between FIFA and Pro Evolution Soccer.
Where oh, I remember.
PES didn't have licenses for a lot of the official teams, so...
Yup.
It could be that they're going to be doing trading card games, like we know they have WWE Supercard, so they could end up doing like a trading card type game.
That could be interesting. I want to see them do like, I want to see arcade games, man.
Sure.
I want to see a return to sports arcade games. Let's do like NBA Jam, but like with football.
Yeah, well, there used to be NFL Blitz, and the reason why NFL Blitz fell off the radar is because it was so violent. Oh. And then you had the head injury issues that started emerging.
Oh.
So it was the NFL's like, no, we cannot glorify violence in football, especially where you have these sounds of like helmets getting smacked together.
Oh, okay. So, no, but I'm talking about NBA Jam.
Yes, more but NBA. Like, bring us more NBA Jam.
NBA Jam, but like you can do it for football, yep. right?
Or maybe... Or like FIFA Street or NBA Street.
NBA Street. Oh, yeah. Man. Those are the kinds of sports. Okay, so like for real... I'm never going to be a huge sim fan when it comes to sports games. I love me some sports puck,
mm-hmm.
right? I like NHL games because I am ferociously Canadian and I can't not be. So I like NHL games, but I have liked them less and less as they become more and more geared towards sims.
Mm-hmm.
I just want NHL 95.
But wasn't the last NHL or one of the last couple of NHL games they packed in like 95 on the disc?
Sure did.
That's awesome.
I love NHL 95. But yeah. For real, I want to, those are the kinds of games that I'd love to see from 2K. If they're going to do something mobile, I want to see them do something stupid and silly and ridiculous and over the top. I think that would be super fun.
Or give me turn-based football, like Blood Bowl.
Ugh.
But like...
What are you going to do with... Can you imagine?
No, but I mean without the murder.
No, I'm not talking about it.
Without the murder. No murder.
Oh my goodness. Can you imagine though? Turn-based, I mean, it's already kind of turn-based football. If you think about football as a sport, it's kind of turn-based.
Are you thinking about baseball? Baseball's kind of turn-based.
No, it's all really boring because it's not sports puck.
But the reason I wanted to call this out. So exclusivity here is important because yes. it preserves the Ultimate Team aspect of the business, which is where the yeah. recurrent revenue comes in.
Which helps fund a lot of other initiatives at sure does. EA.
Yep. Now, with... You assume that if the exclusivity had expired and the door was thrown open, that Visual Concepts might be really excited to make another sim game. And the reason why that would have been interesting is because...
Wait, who's Visual Concepts? Just for people that don't understand.
They make NBA 2K.
Right.
And they also made WWE this year, but we're not going to talk about that because that game was bad.
Maybe it should have been another basketball game.
Yeah. So NBA 2K, my team earning. So my team is the NBA 2K version or style yes. of Ultimate Team, where you're opening up packs of cards and you're putting your teams together.
Yeah.
During the fourth quarter, this is from Take-Two's last earnings report. During the fourth quarter, both recurrent consumer spending on full game sales of NBA 2K20 significantly outperformed our expectations. Consumer engagement with NBA 2K remained at record levels throughout fiscal 2020, with daily active users growing 13% and my team users increasing nearly 50%. During the fourth quarter, over 9 million hours of NBA 2K gameplay were watched on Twitch across more than 1,100 channels, representing a 40% increase over the third quarter. And the strong engagement began prior to people sheltering at home and resulted in recurrent consumer spending growth of 18% in the fourth quarter, reversing our expectation of a decline. Now, we're talking about EA and their relationship, but if they had lost exclusivity and 2K jumped back into the NFL pool... then you would have seen EA suddenly having to shift their revenue perspectives in such a way that they were no longer the only game in town. So it would have, had some long-term repercussions for EA's bottom line.
Sure.
So the fact that they were able to resecure their exclusive agreement with the NFL and the Players Association means that we're likely to see that growth for Madden continue at least through 2026.
Yay, sports ball!
Yay, sports ball. Speaking of Take-Two, though, there was an interesting story that popped up.
As a result of an SEC filing, as it turns out.
Yes. You want to talk about this one?
Sure, why not? So Take-Two, just we talked about their financials last week. So what ended up happening is there were some stories that were coming out based on some speculation about marketing spend.
Yes.
When it came to Take-Two.
And so, this was specifically called out by an analyst.
Yes, it wasn't because of any outlets that were making wild speculations. Mm-hmm. It was because this was coming from a reputable analyst. So Jeff Cohen, who is at the investment firm Stevens, circulated a note to his clients that called out an anticipated $83 million in marketing spend from Take-Two in 2023. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is several years in the future at this point, even fiscal years in the future at this point, that they're speculating about. So Cohen made the assumption that this marketing spend, this $83 million marketing spend, made the assumption that this pointed to a GTA 6 release timing.
Mm-hmm.
And so after that, it ended up going wide.
Yes. So GameSpeak picked it up.
Yes.
And other people picked it up from there. Now, the really challenging thing here, and this is a conversation that you and I used to have when you were the EIC of Game Daily, all the time, and that analyst reports are speculative. They are not primary sources.
No.
They're often very interesting. They often provide insight.
And context.
And context, yeah, absolutely.
Which is why with the vast majority of our stories that dealt with anything to do with the market or finances or projections or anything like that, we always brought in at least one, probably two analysts to talk about their perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was really important to couch that in, this is their perspectives, this is how this is providing additional context.
Absolutely. And, you know, what happens sometimes is you get data that gets filtered through an analyst.
Because as journalists, we don't have access to any of that information.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then you write a story about it. Now, sometimes you're going to find out that that the analyst was spot on and they really understood it and they had not only good data, but good perspective on the data. Sometimes you're going to find out that the analyst generated data, and you and I started to learn this over our years about, hey, this analyst firm's data that looks forward isn't always great, but their analysis of existing data is always really good. So you start to learn like which analyst firms
you can rely on for forecasting, which analyst firms you can rely on for looking backward and analyzing past patterns. Sometimes there are firms that are pretty good at both, that understand the past in order to forecast the future. Nothing is foolproof. Like when we had this conversation with Matt Piscatella back in the very early days of our podcast, nothing is set in stone. Everything moves all the time. This is a very challenging industry to predict.
Yes. The challenge here is, and this is an industry-wide problem, is stories are written, and even in those stories, it could clearly call out either in the headline, have the word analyst or analyst report or financial.
We did that on Game Daily all the time where we would mark it as an analyst report, or we would mark it as just a report so that folks would know, hey, this is not our data. We are not going out and talking to these primary sources. This is a report that we have gathered from our analyst friends.
Absolutely. And it could be called out in the lead, as it was with the GamesBeat story.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is a really, really good story. And and Jeff's follow-up to this was fantastic as well. If not for Jeff, we wouldn't have the full story, for crying out loud.
Absolutely. So it's important when you are sharing stories. It's important when you're not just looking at the headline, or if you see the word analyst in the headline, that you understand that data might not be spot on. In fact, like, especially when you're talking about huge games, like every analyst firm that deals in mobile is talking about Fortnite, and, you know, I'm sure they're still talking about Clash Royale and Clash of Clans and all, you know, or whatever the new hotness, you know, in mobile is, that's making a ton of money. It's still Fortnite.
It's 100% still Fortnite.
Their numbers, and PUBG. Epic we'll talk from time to time about how many subscribers it is or how many accounts there are or how many players there are playing Fortnite, but Epic hasn't talked about the amount of money. So if you see a report that says, oh, Fortnite's made this much money, well, that's coming from an analyst firm that is using context and using data that it has access to draw, you know, to try to put a picture together of how right. much money they believe is coming into that game.
Yes.
Through that channel.
Yes. And the analyst firms do have access to some form of that data through things like, you know, like App Annie. Mm-hmm. It's challenging. This, if you report on the industry like we do, like VentureBeat does, GamesIndustry.biz, Gamasutra, everything like that, like it is, and Game Daily, of course, it's really, really hard because mm-hmm. we're starved for data.
Yep.
All the time.
And that is a big challenge about reporting on this industry, is that unlike the movie industry, which talks about its budgets,
oh, yeah.
talks about its openly. Timelines openly, talks about its casting very openly.
We don't have that.
We don't have that. So because there is that lack of information, you've seen a lot of business journalists, especially leaning on analyst reports. It turns out that Take-Two was able to clarify this for Gamesbeat,
yes.
and said that this marketing obligation metric refers only to its contracts with third parties. So that's media buys and things like that. It doesn't reflect its marketing budget for internal studios like Rockstar Games. It means it doesn't indicate a timeline for GTA 6. But we wanted to talk about it because we see these stories pop up about that come from analysts so often. And I think that there are a lot of people who read whether... And again, this gets filtered, and you and I have had this conversation a lot, where it's being reported on a business site. And then it gets re-reported on an enthusiast outlet, and the analyst piece of
consumer-facing outlet, yes.
A consumer-facing outlet, and that analyst stuff gets stripped out. So it suddenly goes from, hey, we got this analyst report, the analyst called this out, the analyst says that they believe that this is pointing to this, in this case GTA 6, it gets over to some consumer-facing outlets, and it's suddenly GTA 6 is coming out in 2023 because Take-Two is gonna spend this much money. And you lose all of that context, or you're reporting... It isn't contextualized by that author because the author doesn't quite understand what an analyst report is. So it doesn't get contextualized for a consumer readership.
And that's the tough part about bridging that gap and mm-hmm. making sure that consumer-facing outlets have what they need in order to take care of their audiences. And they're like, I mean, consumer-facing outlets are getting better and better about this. They're getting better about business coverage because they're taking cues from some of the best business writers in the industry. So... all the only way out is through, man. Yeah.
And, you know, again, to bring this up, it wasn't to shine a light on the error. It was more to talk about
how we got there
and why it's important to understand, especially in business reporting, what an analyst source is most of the time
mm-hmm.
and what those analyst reports look like. In this case, it was a note that came from an analyst to their investors.
Yeah, it was an internal report.
Yep. And, you know, we as journalists, we as people in the industry, we sometimes get those.
Every once in a while.
If you are working full time for an outlet like GamesBeat or Games Industry, you're probably getting those on a regular basis from
True.
A wide range of analysts who cover the industry. So it's important to understand, again, that chain of things, how it went from an analyst reports identifying this increased marketing commitment all the way through what was in the public was... GTA 6 is like coming out in 2023. We know that for sure now because of this.
Right.
So it goes from this confusion of starting with an analyst and then becoming
fact.
Some fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the only folks that can make that fact would be the folks at Take-Two.
Yep.
So.
Or a reporter with excellent internal sources that are well-placed and would have expert knowledge of.
And would probably be at Take-Two.
Yeah, exactly. All right, that takes us to our final topic, and this is an exciting one, because it is heading us toward a very exciting holiday, where now both Microsoft and Sony have recommitted yet again
Woo!
That we're going to see both consoles globally this holiday.
Globally.
So,
but we don't know if that means China.
True. Very true.
Actually, Dan called that out today. Dan Ahmad. He's just like, I don't know. It took PlayStation 4 8 months to get certified.
Which back then wasn't that long.
It might be a lot longer now. Yeah. It might be closer to 18 months. So we will see if it's truly...
So that takes us to Microsoft detailing extensively.
Yes.
Putting a fine point on how Xbox Series X backward compatibility is going to work.
I'm so excited about this.
Me too.
Back compat is such an important part of the Microsoft ecosystem at this point. Being able to play older Xbox games on my Xbox One, and then, and once we get the Xbox Series X, being able to play Xbox One games that I 100% miss because I have 100% zero time.
We are going to have to figure out where to put my old Xbox, my OG Xbox game library. Because that's in storage, because I don't know.
I don't know what to do about any of that. You have a lot of video games.
I do have a lot of video games.
We give them to Steven. That's what we do.
All right. So here was the big thing that jumped, or the big things that jumped out to us.
Yes.
First, if you pop in, I assume, a disc, and this is going to be the tricky part. We know it will work with discs. You have an OG Xbox game. You have an Xbox 360 game. You have an Xbox One game. You pop it into your Xbox Series X. It's not going to be running in an emulator. It's going to run natively on the Xbox Series.
Yes. That's enormous.
Yeah.
That's super, super cool.
It is. My question, and this is the big hurdle they have to jump, is that there are some games, and even some OG Xbox games, because they were upgraded for Xbox One X, that are available digitally on the Microsoft Store.
Right.
However, you've got this huge library of original Xbox games. I don't know if many of those are going to end up being available digitally, which means you're still going to need those discs. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have access to that full library day one if you've never owned those games before.
Sure.
It simply means that you, if you have them, if you have that what is now a classic library, you'll be able to make use of it.
Michael, it was almost 20 years ago.
I know.
Do you feel old now?
I feel so old.
I feel super old too.
Yeah. Good news is, and we caught this 2 years ago at E3, gaming peripherals will carry forward. So your Xbox One Elite controller will work
on your Xbox Series X. I love my Elite controller. The new ones are so pretty and they look like they're even better.
I am not going to get one of those. I'm going to wait till the Xbox Series X version to upgrade. Because if I go out and buy a $200 controller right now, Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. On top of all of the Kickstarters?
But we're not going to... That is a different podcast.
Wait, we have another podcast about Kickstarters? We don't,
and we're never talking about it again.
Whoops, my bad. All right. So yes, gaming peripherals will be able to carry forward.
So there were 500 Xbox 360 games that eventually made it to Xbox One through the backward compatibility program. Just 500.
That's it?
Just 500. Which is a lot of games, but...
But the Xbox 360 had a ton of games.
Thousands of games. All the way back to the original Xbox, the Xbox 360 and the Xbox One playable on Xbox Series X on the first day. And that excites me. Like that, I feel like backwards compatibility has been a feature that I've loved having. This was back on the Xbox 360, popped in a bunch of OG Xbox games. They used to come in like waves. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
They're big updates.
Oh, yeah. I definitely remember that. I used to do that with my brother a lot because my brother is he's the collector. Mm-hmm. I was never really the collector. Now I live in a household where everybody's a collector. So, yeah, I like the idea of it. I don't usually use it myself all that often, but I do like being able to point our youngest kids to some of those older games, like seeing our littlest son playing Civ Rev, from the 360, because I think that was a 360 game, right?
It was, yeah.
Yeah. And he's playing it on the Xbox One.
Yep. It's pretty great.
It's pretty amazing, actually. So yeah, I really appreciate what it's able to do for our kids and being able to show them, hey, this is what games were like. These are some of the things that we liked playing in the previous generations.
Now, For someone like me, like, it's a feature that gets a lot of use. For someone like you, and this might push you over the edge.
Okay.
So they're going to be able to do some cool stuff, and they started building out some of this tech with the Xbox One, you know, those Xbox One X upgrades that exist for the OG Xbox games. So automatic upgrades, like, they're talking about, in this, for the Xbox Series X, like, automatic upgrades to HDR.
Ooh.
Yeah. So on our 4K TV out there, that's going to look pretty great. But they're also talking about being able to get smoother frame rates.
Oh,
so for games that used to hitch, like, not as big a deal. Improved resolutions. Again, we've seen that on some of the OG Xbox games that have been updated for Xbox One X and the Xbox 360 games that have had those capabilities included. They have done 100,000 hours of testing already on backwards compatibility.
100,000 hours.
They expect that to double by launch.
Dip. That's a lot of hours.
Additionally, because these games are running on... on the new hardware natively and non-software emulation, they're going to be supporting the quick resume features where you can have multiple games in save states.
Yes.
Or in suspend states.
That's pulling heavily from the way that Windows tends to handle things, which is nice. I love being able to see that over on a console. Because, I mean, again, gaming should be for everybody, and you shouldn't have to have a PC to have, you know, those quality of life upgrades, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And they also called out game preservation. That this is, that it's important from a, again, we talk about the different meanings of preservation. There's the academic preservation angle, but this is the populace preservation angle where, you know, people should be able to easily play the games that they've collected throughout, you know, the life of a console family, I guess.
Console family. I like that.
Yeah.
As opposed to a console ecosystem.
Yes. Well, console family, I mean, the family thing was back when, this goes back to, like, Diablo 3. You could bring your characters over within the same console family. It was, like, PS3 to PS4, Xbox 360. Xbox.
Everything's a lot all the time.
It is. So, there's no boost mode, no downclocking. Although, I don't know why they call that out as a bad thing, because downclocking is typically used, and you and I have both seen this in older games, where if they're not coded in such a way, they'll just go and fast forward.
Yep.
Because the processor speed, like the clock speed's so fast, so they have to down. You have to down clock in order to, like, you know, yank on the reins just a little bit.
Yep.
And so better frame rates, better resolution, and faster load times, so they'll be able to take advantage of the solid state drive stuff.
That's really exciting. Yeah. It's exciting stuff, and it's exciting as a parent specifically because I love sharing some of these older games with our kids and being able to take them back through some of the games that we liked in the previous generations of. The console family.
Yeah. You know what? I hope I still have my copy of Conker's Bad Fur Day on OG Xbox.
That's an awful thing.
I will play that with the kids.
No, you will absolutely not play that with our children. Okay. You will play it with me.
Oh, okay. When I originally wrote these show notes, we had some big question marks about Sony, but those question marks are about to become answers, at least some of them.
Some of them are about to become answers, that's for sure. So Sony is going to be holding a big PlayStation 5 digital event next week on June 4th at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. We're about to see how Sony is planning on rolling out the PlayStation 5. And this is beyond the hardware specs, and this is beyond Mark Cerny's ASMR for Nerds, which, gosh, I should just go back and watch like 5 or 6 more times. It's just such a great presentation. But yeah, we're about to see how Sony is gonna handle its rollout and how it's gonna handle its own ecosystem.
And there we have some hints early on, and here's what I'm gonna say about this. Last generation was about significantly different hardware profiles.
Yes.
The PS4 outpowered the Xbox One, right? Microsoft was leaning so hard on its all-in-one entertainment device that it kind of ceded the power struggle.
Yikes.
To Sony. So the PlayStation 4, so games were performing better on PlayStation 4 than they were on Xbox One. Now that has shifted throughout the generation because Xbox One X is, I believe, more powerful than PlayStation 4 Pro.
It's so marginal.
It is.
But that's the thing, right? That's the thing about the end of this generation leading into next generation. It is not about the hardware profiles.
It isn't.
It is not about which console is going to have a better solid state or has better data architecture or deals with graphics better or whatever. Both of these systems they look fairly comparable in terms of their hardware.
You know, obviously services are going to be a big thing here. Microsoft, as we have talked about for years, has been about broadening itself from a console into an ecosystem.
Yes. Xbox the platform as opposed to Xbox the console.
Absolutely. And Sony, you know, we were kind of left wondering like, okay, so Microsoft, they're doing some interesting things. Obviously, Game Pass is going to be a big part of Xbox Series X. This smart delivery thing, I keep coming back to it as one of the most consumer-friendly...
It's such an enormous hooray.
It is. So, you know, you buy a game that's coming out before the Xbox Series X. You play it on Xbox One. For a number of games, you get the Xbox Series X version immediately and pick up right where you left off.
Like, what if I don't want to wait? I don't want to wait to play Cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play it now.
And we did, in fact, pre-order the Xbox One version.
So that we could do the smart delivery for the Xbox Series X when we're able to purchase that console. So, I mean, being able to make those forward-thinking purchases mm-hmm. as pre-orders right now is so powerful. And it really speaks to the way that Xbox is treating the next generation as opposed to how Sony is treating the next generation. Now, remember, this is not about starting console wars. Yeah. We're in 2020. Console wars are moot.
Yep.
They don't matter. Nintendo's going to eat everybody's lunch anyway.
Yep. This is about, and I said this on Twitter, what we are going to see is Microsoft and Sony seem to be headed down very different philosophical paths.
Which is awesome.
It is.
It's genuinely really cool because we want that. We want to be able to see that variety between all of the big three. We want Nintendo to do its own thing. We want Microsoft to do its own thing. And we want Sony to do its own thing. We just want Sony to do crossplay.
Yep. So there were two pieces of news that came out.
Yes, around let's talk this. About this.
The first one is that, so when they talked about backwards compatibility, when Mark Cerny talked about it during ASMR for Nerds, they talked about...
That's its official name now.
I know. Most of the PlayStation 4 library will be playable on the PlayStation 5. Eurogamer reported today that partners are being told that any game that goes through CERT, which is...
Arduous?
It can be. So what CERT is you have to submit your code to the platform holders, CERT, FQA, lot check, depends on the platform holder. It's called different things. So when you're going through CERT, you have to get a green light on everything. You're missing something, it gets kicked back. You have to fix it and go back. And that can be something as simple as you have the wrong button callouts. You've got Xbox buttons when you should have PlayStation buttons on that build.
Also, don't call it X, it's cross.
Yes. That is a thing.
I know it's a thing. That's why I said it.
So if you're going through CERT after July 13th, your PS4 game must be playable on PS5. Essentially what that means is your game must be prepared for backwards compatibility on PS5.
Sure.
That doesn't mean you have a PS5 version of the game. It doesn't mean that you're taking advantage of the PS5 optimized features, whatever those might be, for your game. It just means that your PlayStation 4 game will be ready to be played as a PS4 game on PS5.
Yes.
So it's really about backwards compatibility. It's not a forwards compatibility conversation. It's a backwards compatibility conversation.
Which is really interesting considering that Sony has been, for the most part, fairly against backwards compatibility throughout its various generations of consoles.
In fact, it was Jim Ryan who took a firm stand against backwards compatibility. The other piece of this is that Eurogamer is reporting that Sony is, quote, strongly recommending that developers and publishers update their existing PS4 games for PS5 compatibility if they are not there yet. In other words, Sony is saying, we want as much of our existing PS4 library to be playable on day one on PS5, which is great.
But they're leaving it up to the developers to do it.
Exactly. And
which is very different than how Microsoft is handling it, which is very much so on a platform level.
It is. And I kind of came back to this one thing. Our eldest son was asking for games that he could play. And I said, oh, man. So we're looking at T games for him right now. And he's playing
Soft T.
Although he's playing the remastered Uncharted trilogy.
Okay, so that's pretty hard.
That's a harder T. But I was saying, like, okay, Infamous is a T. But there is no good way for me to hand him my disc copies of Infamous 1 or Infamous 2 and play them on a PlayStation 4.
Nope.
Or my copy of Folklore, for instance. By the way, that game's awesome. And that would benefit from something like faster frame rates and load times, because every time you open up the menu, it hitches and that sort of thing. Folklore's great. So the other piece of this is, you know, they announced the June 4th event today. GamesIndustry.biz had an interview with Jim Ryan, and there are a couple of quotes in there that directly address. Now, remember, Microsoft has said that for at least the first year, could be up to two, you're not going to see first-party exclusive Xbox Series X exclusive games. They're going to be playable on Xbox One and Xbox Series X. Now, that's not necessarily the case for third parties. We do know that there are some Xbox Series X exclusives coming from third party, or Xbox Series X and PlayStation 5 exclusives coming from third parties. So there were a couple quotes here that jumped out about what Sony is thinking about this.
All right, so here's what Jim Ryan had to say. Quote, we have always said that we believe in generations. We believe that when you go to all the trouble of creating a next-gen console, that it should include features and benefits that the previous generation does not include.
I feel like this is kind of, there's a little bit of a straw man thing going on, because...
A little bit.
The Xbox Series X versions of some of these games will include those new features.
It will. I think that this is very much so coming down to Jim Ryan's approach to consoles, which is about exclusivity.
Yep.
And it is about we really, really want you to buy a PlayStation 5. This is what we're going to do to get you to get a PlayStation 5. Mm-hmm. This isn't about, you know, us fully supporting the PlayStation 4 or anything backwards back there. We're forward looking. We're always looking toward the future, which is a very Jim Ryan thing to do.
Absolutely. He also said, in our view, people should make games that can make the most of those features, whether it's the DualSense controller, whether it's the 3D audio, whether it's the multiple ways that the solid state drive can be used. We're thinking that it's time to give the PlayStation community something new, something different that can really only be enjoyed on PS5. I don't know enough about the DualSense controller yet to know what those features might be.
It's a pretty looking controller.
It is a pretty looking controller. I'm looking forward to learning more, hopefully next week. Again, 3D audio, I really enjoyed.
It's honestly, in multiplayer games, 3D audio is a game changer.
Yeah.
Like, we've been playing World War Z mm-hmm. with our best friend Adam, and I'm telling you, There are some times where that 3D audio and there's a lurker hanging around and you got to go shoot that lurker. I'm telling you, that 3D audio is a game changer.
Yep.
And a lifesaver.
And we don't know how it's going to work exactly on console. We don't know what it's going to sound like. I got the impression that it's going to be even better than the stuff that we're seeing on PC, because it's going to be tailored to, there's different profiles depending on your ear structure and all of that.
And especially, so if you're really curious about how PlayStation is going to handle this, I seriously go and watch Mark Cerny's presentation.
Yeah, that part was so cool.
It was legitimately one of the coolest things I've seen in a presentation about a console possibly ever. I love the way Cerny talks about PlayStation's architecture, and especially the 3D audio. The data architecture as well was really interesting, but that 3D audio and the way that they understand spatial audio is just, mm-hmm. oh, it's so cool.
I mean, and I want to be clear, we're buying a PlayStation 5, we're buying an Xbox Series X.
Oh, for sure.
We are a platform agnostic house.
With our four switches.
Yeah, our business is platform agnostic. So we don't really have a dog in this race. We're going to play games. You know, I'm looking forward to playing the exclusives that are on the Xbox consoles. I'm looking forward to playing the exclusives that are on the PlayStation consoles on Switch.
We just really like video games.
It's true.
Like a lot.
So when I push back on some of this, I'm curious. I'm very eager to see next week and beyond how Sony kind of addresses some of this. Because, for instance, why couldn't a game that plays on PS4 and PS5 with something like a smart delivery setup where you've got two different versions where the new version takes advantage of those features, why couldn't the PS5 version take advantage of those DualSense controllers? Why couldn't the PS5 version take advantage of the 3D audio? And we know, like, Microsoft has already said, hey, we're using the solid state drive, you know, for games going all the way back to the original Xbox. So we know that it's possible. So I'm curious.
I think it's philosophical. I think that's what this really comes down
exactly.
to, is that Jim Ryan has always been this kind of a leader. He's very interested in the PlayStation community as always looking forward, as always going to the next thing and being the best that it can be. And, you know, I can support that from that perspective of really like, rah, rah, PlayStation. I just really want to play some older PlayStation games.
Yeah.
I want to play some PlayStation 3 games. There are some amazing PlayStation 3 games that I never got to play. And I never will be able to play because nothing but a PlayStation 3 can play. And
yep.
try to get one of those to work these days.
I mean, we could hook ours up, but it's kind of a pain.
My PlayStation 3 died.
Oh, well,
we have
one in the drawer right there.
Terrible, horrible death. It was very sad.
I mean, so I guess my point is, like, I believe in taking advantage of the new features on whichever piece of hardware to the fullest. I love the consumer approach the consumer friendly approach that Microsoft is taking. I wish Sony would take a similar approach, because we have built up these huge libraries. I have so many PS1 games, so many PS2 games.
But how many of people in our community have the space and the room for large gaming libraries in an economy like this?
Okay. Then I will flip this on its developer-friendly head, or its publisher-friendly head.
There we go.
If you've got these games, right, and your licensing agreements and whatever agreements that you signed are compatible with it, you have this library where you could re-release these games that take advantage of the new features of the new consoles. And what I think we might end up seeing, and I don't know this for sure, and we won't know until we get into the next generation, both pieces of hardware are released, that if we start seeing games that were released on the OG Xbox and the Xbox 360 that were also released on PS2 and PS3 start coming digitally to Microsoft Store where people can buy them again. You're creating a new revenue stream for existing software. You are injecting new revenue potentially for developers and publishers, for people who want to go back and play those games, or who had a physical copy and sold or traded or lost their physical copy and want to just own that game again and play it because they have such fond memories of it. You know, that could be Jack and Daxter, you know, Jack and Daxter 2, you know, Jack 2, Jack 3, right? It could be some of these games on PlayStation, Infamous 1 and Infamous 2. Now,
Ratchet and Clank.
Ratchet and Clank, the original, not the remaster, which was good, or the remake, which was good. You have all these games, and unless Sony really starts promoting PlayStation Now, which I really think it should, because
it has the largest install base out there. Mm-hmm. It really does. PlayStation Now has the biggest subscriber base. It's bigger than Xbox Game Pass. We talk about Game Pass a lot mm-hmm. on this show.
Yeah, I think Sony is leaving money on the table when it comes to PlayStation Now, because a Game Pass like setup for Sony's ecosystem would go a long, long way.
Well, this has been, what is this, episode 24?
I think it is episode 24.
Episode 24. So thanks for hanging out with us. This has been episode 24 of the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I'm at Amanda Farrow.
I'm at Footerish, FUTTERISH. And you can subscribe to Virtual Economy. If this is your first time here, welcome. We're glad to have you. If you would like to subscribe to the show, you can do so at virtualeconomy.libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on your favorite podcast delivery service, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, Podcast Addict. Oops, another podcast. I just made that one up. So please do subscribe. It lets the algorithm gods know that we're worth paying attention to. And if possible, on your platform of choice, if you can review us, hey, we'd love to know what you think. You can also DM us with questions or that feedback, or you can send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
Speaking of F Squared, Virtual Economy is an F Squared initiative, and along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way that we are working to give back to the community. To find out more about F Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz. I am not spelling it out, Michael. You can't make me.
FSQUARED.BIZ.
Every time.
I know. And we will be back next week. We don't usually do this, but I'm excited. Next week on the show, we are welcoming Troy Baker to talk about voice performance and performance capture during the pandemic. Obviously, that is one aspect of things. Actors can't get into the studio.
How are you supposed to do your job?
So we're going to talk about that. So we're excited to do that. That show will probably be live on Wednesday during the day because we're talking to Troy on Tuesday.
Yep.
So in the meantime, please wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you next week.